Americans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
And your host is humbled by the subscription supporters of this program, including Kathleen Emmer, Jeffrey Zeiser, Gary Washington, and Michelle Pasco. Thank you for your support. After a seven-year odyssey in the courts, the single wiretapping case that won a verdict at the trial court level is coming to an end. In the early days of this important challenge to the government's use of illegal wiretapping, attorney John B. Eisenberg has been very generous with his time and granted me over a dozen interviews. And he joins us today, at least for the last time, on this particular case, the Al Haramain Charity versus first Bush and then Obama. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Peter. It's great to be with you once again.
And I do want to thank you at the outset here for all the conversations that we've had. And I don't want this to sound like a memorial service. I look forward to talking to you in the future when you take on other important cases. But as you wrote in the law publication, the Daily Journal, this is the single biggest case of your career. And you have reluctantly decided that you're not going to pursue an appeal to the Supreme Court. And just briefly, for listeners who are hearing about this for the first time, go to peterbcollins.com, put Eisenberg into the search window, and many of these interviews will pop up and you can catch up on the story. But to summarize briefly, you brought a case against the government on behalf of two attorneys who represented a now-defunct Oregon charity. You were able to prove through a document that slipped through the cracks of the FBI that you had been wiretapped. Ultimately, you didn't use that secret document because the government retrieved it and disallowed it as evidence, but you were able to prove through public records that your clients, the attorneys, were wiretapped. And now retired Judge Vaughn Walker on the federal bench here in San Francisco wrote a ruling that established the violation of the FISA law by the government of your clients, awarded modest damages and also modest attorney fees for the hundreds of hours of now unbillable time that you put into this case. And with that quick summation, explain to our listeners why you have made this difficult decision not to move forward with appeals.
Well, while it is true that we won before Judge Walker in 2010, and he ruled that the president may not disregard the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and he ruled that our clients were unlawfully wiretapped, and he awarded a modest amount of damages to them and actually a fairly large amount of attorney's fees to us, for thousands, not hundreds of hours of work put into the case.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all that is true, and we won this case before Judge Walker late in 2012. I almost said earlier this year, but it's now 2013. Late in 2012, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed our judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And what the court held was that regardless of whether or not we could prove that our clients were unlawfully surveilled, and regardless of President Bush's violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, we couldn't sue for it. In other words, the president could get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why the court said we couldn't sue for this obvious illegal conduct is that the executive, that's the president and the executive branch of government, enjoys sovereign immunity from lawsuits.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the idea is that the sovereign being traditionally the king.
Yeah.
In merry old England, you couldn't sue the king unless the king authorized you to sue him or the queen, her. That law has trickled down into U.S. jurisprudence, the idea being now that we don't have a king, but we do have a president, and you can't sue the president unless Congress allows you to do so, says expressly, there is a law here, it may not be violated, and if the executive violates the law, the victims may sue. The Ninth Circuit ruled that when Congress passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, they did not waive sovereign immunity. They did not authorize the president to be sued, even though the entire act is designated toward preventing illegal activity by the president.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is, from the Ninth Circuit in 2012, maybe you got wiretapped, maybe you can prove it, maybe it's illegal, but you can't do anything about it. So what I'm fond of telling my friends is that we filed this lawsuit 7 years ago in order to establish a principle. The president may not violate an act of Congress in the name of national security. Instead, the Ninth Circuit said he can get away with it. So
now, the one step I'm missing here is that we last spoke after the three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit issued that sovereign immunity-based ruling. And then did you, in fact, ask for an en banc ruling from the Ninth Circuit?
We did.
Okay.
We filed a petition for review en banc, meaning asking the case be reviewed not just by the panel of three that we had,
mm-hmm.
but by a panel of 11, a larger panel to review the whole case. We asserted a number of reasons why this would be appropriate. The main reason we asserted had to do with some of the reasoning in the court's opinion. The court said you can't sue for unlawful collection of the information here, but you can sue, you could have sued for unlawful use of it under a certain statute. You just sued under the wrong statute.
Hmm.
And that was flat out wrong. The statute they cited did not, in fact, allow us to sue for unlawful collection because that statute had to do with unlawful use of lawfully collected surveillance. Our surveillance was never lawfully collected. It was unlawful from the outset. That's a real technicality, but suffice it to say, we read the opinion, we realized the government, that the court had made a really fundamental mistake, and we filed a petition for rehearing, hoping that they would address the mistake, and at least if we were going to lose, make the loss a more jurisprudentially viable one, if I can be
mm-hmm.
polite. The opinion they wrote just didn't work. It was not consistent with the statute they were relying on. So we asked for a rehearing. We didn't get it. They completely disregarded the point that we had raised. And so we became faced with yet another crossroads in this case. What do we do about this? The Ninth Circuit has ruled in a decision that's binding in all the states that are within the Ninth Circuit, that's generally the Western states. They have ruled that the president may not be sued for breaking the FISA law. Even if he wiretaps you without a warrant, there's nothing you can do about it. You cannot sue for the unlawful surveillance. That's a ruling in the Ninth Circuit. We could have asked the U.S. Supreme Court to take the case. Now, we feel, first of all, it's very unlikely the Supreme Court would take the case, given this current Supreme Court. Four, five, maybe six of the judges on this court would have liked this decision. However, in more concern, in the unlikely event the Supreme Court did take the case, our fear was that we would lose even worse. And if we lose even more, because of, I mean that because of the ideological tilt of this current Supreme Court. If we lose even worse in the Supreme Court, that decision is binding all over the country,
right?
Not just in the Ninth Circuit. So what we decided was that at this point, despite 7 years of awfully hard work and a real serious attempt to make some good law here, this isn't a good time to keep going forward. We should let it go and hope that 5, 10, 20 years from now, maybe in this country we'll have a prevailing climate that's less charged by post-9/11 fears. We might have a better Supreme Court. What I had in mind personally is what happened with Fred Korematsu, who sued in the 40s to challenge the internment of the Japanese-American citizens during World War II. He sued. He lost. How many decades later? Was it 50 years later? He sued again and eventually got the compensation, reparations, a small amount of money, but acknowledgement by the U.S. government that they'd done wrong. I mean, that's the sort of thing I have in mind, not to compare myself to Fred Korematsu at all, but the same general idea is now might be the time to let this go and hope the battle can be taken up again a half a generation or a generation from now and have some vindication of what we have been trying to do.
Well, John, I have a couple of reactions. One is that I feel strongly that your decision is not based on ego. And there are some attorneys who would just get infuriated and say, damn it all, I'm going to take my chances and see what we can get. And so I also appreciate the practical considerations that after 7 years and no compensation for this, that you have to make a decision about whether it's viable and a useful application of your time and talent. The other side, though, of my feeling is that your kind of expansive view of a generation of illegal wiretapping and clear violations of the Fourth Amendment and the I think her name is O'Connor, the judge in New York, recently ruled in the case challenging the basis for the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki. And the government has secret memos that were used to legally justify that. There's a new John Yoo, we don't know who he or she is, in the Justice Department, who served up the rationale for what is a clear violation of the Fifth Amendment rights of Mr. al-Awlaki, an American citizen, his associate, and his 16-year-old son, a true innocent, who wound up being killed in a separate drone strike.
Yeah.
And she referred to her own frustration that, you know, she's fenced in by legal precedents and by the aggressive work of the federal government at the behest of the president to extend these dangerous precedents. And so my concern is that this was the one case that gave us hope for some challenge to what I view as clearly illegal activity that occurred, and as you say, the president is being given a pass.
There is currently another case in the works being pursued by the Electronic Frontier Foundation called JEWEL, J-E-W-E-L, and they commenced it after losing one of their earlier pieces of litigation that was consolidated with Al Haramain and dozens of others before Walker a long time ago. They are currently in the federal district court in San Francisco litigating whether or not FISA preempts the state secrets privilege. Their case is a little bit like the Al Haramain case, but much, much broader. And it really focuses more on the data collection that goes on at the AT&T facility on Folsom Street, where all emails go into that building and it gets split and into two emails. One goes to the NSA and one goes to the recipient. They have this piece of litigation now pending. They have really continued to fight for the broader principles that animated us in the Al-Haramain case. And so it's not as if it's all over for any of this type of litigation. It's all over for a narrow case challenging the warrantless wiretapping program.
Mm-hmm.
It's not all over for some of the other stuff that went on under the Bush administration. EFF continues to fight, and I wish them well. However, I am not particularly hopeful about the outcome in that case or in the Clapper case that's in the U.S. Supreme Court or any national security litigation. It's not that these lawsuits aren't being prosecuted very well. They're being prosecuted marvelously. It's that the appellate courts are shooting them all down. And you're seeing this not just with surveillance, but even worse, I would have to say, with torture, with drone strikes,
mm-hmm.
with detention at Guantanamo. Time and again, none of these cases are succeeding. None of them. And the president, instead of fighting hard, what's he done most recently? He signed the most recent defense authorization bill and then issued a signing statement. So he authorizes stuff he claimed he never would have authorized, and then he does something he claims he never would have done, the signing statement. And
mm-hmm.
so we don't have an executive that's doing anything to lead us out of the darkness in these issues, and we don't have federal appellate courts doing much either. So I'm not hopeful, but there are still plenty of people continuing to fight, and I myself will when next given the opportunity. My point is this case, Al-Haramain, which really was, in my view, the last chance to put the skids on a now-dead program anyway, but the more general idea of expansive presidential power, within the context of what the New York Times revealed in 2005, within the context of the what the government calls the terrorist surveillance program,
mm-hmm.
it's over. We were the last chance. The battleground has shifted to other fields.
John, I want to come back to the point you made a second ago about the way the appellate courts are really providing stopgaps for legitimate cases that are coming forward to them. And you made the point earlier that the Ninth Circuit used what I would characterize as a kind of judicial sleight of hand to claim that you sued under the wrong law.
Yeah.
And similarly, I've been following pretty closely the challenge to the NDAA's of 2012 detention clause,
yeah.
1021B. Carl Mayer is the attorney there for Chris Hedges, Ellsberg et al., and has been, very active in talking with me, and so I'm pretty, for a non-attorney, I feel pretty well schooled on that case. And in a similar manner, they won at the trial court level. Judge Forrest issued a brilliant and blistering decision September 12th of 2012, and issued a permanent injunction against the detention clause of the 2012 NDAA. That was in effect for 5 days.
Yeah.
Then a temporary stay was issued, followed by a three-judge panel that, again, I use the phrase judicial sleight of hand. They inserted what I would call warranties that the plaintiffs had nothing to fear. When at the trial court level, Judge Forrest was infuriated by the repeated refusals of the government to declare that journalists and activists who made up the plaintiff package there had nothing to fear. And the government lawyers kept saying, I can't tell you that. I don't, you know, they were just playing dumb. And then at the appeals level, there is this insertion of something that, from my knowledge of the process, is highly inappropriate. this claim that the plaintiffs have nothing to fear, and therefore the law will return to its full effect. So do you see a pattern here where the appeals courts are really playing games with the process, and I view it as more than a technical issue?
Well, what I see is what I don't see, if I can be a little opaque. We have known all along, well, from very early on, that the government has been submitting secret filings both to Judge Walker at the trial court level and to the three-judge panel at the appellate court level. We also know at one point the government told the appellate court that they had to correct a mistake in some of their prior secret filings. The correction of the mistake was a secret. The mistake itself was a secret. We know that the government has been whispering in the ears of the judges in our case, and we have no idea what is being said. So I have no idea whether or not the secret evidence, the secret comments that the government is feeding to the Ninth Circuit has affected their decision. There's no way for me to know because it's a secret. I've seen something similar in a Guantanamo Bay case that I've been involved in, helping a team of lawyers representing a detainee there. The detainee was detained based on secret informant information that we are not allowed to review, and we do not know the name of the informant, and we will never be allowed to. So this man has been detained without trial, without military commission for 11 years based on secret evidence that we are not allowed to see or challenge.
And similarly, I don't want to get you in trouble, but you can talk about this in a circumspect way. You're not permitted to reveal many of the proceedings and possibly even the name of your client.
Well, we're certainly restrained in that there is classified information in the case, and I can't talk about what it is. And I can't, more importantly, I suppose for purposes of proving the case, I can't rebut how the government attempts to explain it away because I haven't been able to see how they attempt to explain it away.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the broader pattern that I am seeing in my case, in the Guantanamo Bay cases, in every one of these national security cases, is that the government whispers in the ears of the judges, tells them secrets that the litigants aren't allowed to know. This is not how we are supposed to be litigating cases in the United States of America. It's supposed to be a transparent process, not one in which judges hear evidence in secret and rule in secret. I mean, that's out of Kafka or...
Yeah.
Or the Soviet Union,
right,
during Stalin's time,
mm-hmm,
and any number of totalitarian nations I could mention today. I didn't grow up being taught this is how cases are decided in the United States, but it's what's happening now. And so I cannot explain fully what happened in the Al-Haramain case because I don't know everything that was before the court.
Mm-hmm. John, let me ask you to react in your typically measured way to a couple of extreme comments from me. One is that broadly, I see that the courts are permitting nullification of key elements of the Bill of Rights. And secondly, that I see that this leads to a dictatorship with term limits.
Well, speaking to the former, if you can't sue to vindicate the rights that are given to you, whether by statute or constitution, then the rights don't mean much. So the courts allowing nullification of the Bill of Rights, one might argue indirectly so, by depriving victims of standing to vindicate the violation of those rights. That's the great mischief in overly strict standing requirements. Now I'm getting old. I can't remember what your second point was.
Dictatorship with term limits.
Dictatorship with term limits. Well, you know, it's not quite a dictatorship if it's handed to you on a silver platter. I mean, let's not lose sight of the fact that Obama won. He was elected. He's not a dictator. He's a lawfully elected president, chosen by an admittedly very flawed process. The Electoral College is really ridiculous. But there's no arguing the fact that Obama has popular support. How he gets it, how we make our decisions in this country these days, you know, basically by driven by ad agencies, you know.
Well, accepting your point, we still and I'll throw in the other angle here, which is the failure, absolute failure of any meaningful congressional oversight. We have an expansive presidential executive power that does give the executive, whoever it happens to be, the authorization, or at least the lack of any consequences for direct violations of constitutional rights on a fairly broad scale.
Right. We are not living in a dictatorship per se. What we are living in is a government that's dysfunctional, a government that was set up with checks and balances to keep any one branch of the government from acquiring a disproportionate amount of power. In the wake of 9/11, Congress has essentially abdicated much of its role in national security to the president. And oddly enough, when they haven't abdicated, you know, in Guantanamo Bay, they've said the president hasn't gone far enough. This president is a politician above all else. They all are. He's doing what he thinks he can do and what he thinks he needs to do to maintain power. And, you know, I don't know what all pressures he's subject to from within. I do know, as a voter, seeing him break promise after another as a candidate, knuckling under to concepts I never dreamed he would have knuckled under to, and Congress either pushing him along or refusing to do anything about abuses, and the courts taking a very conservative view of what their role is, which the basis is to basically do nothing.
Well, in many cases enabling this expansive view of presidential authority.
Yes. Yeah. So what we have is all three branches of government being so totally dysfunctional, in my view, internally and in interacting between them, as to vest a tremendous amount of power in a president who doesn't really seem to understand what dangerous precedent he is setting. I think Obama thinks it's okay for him to have all this power because he's a good man and he'll use it wisely. And he doesn't seem to understand that the same might not be true of the next president. And if Bush started us down this road and Obama gladly continued running down the road, we're in big trouble because we're going down that road, period, now.
Well, and just to borrow your metaphor, I think Bush established a two-lane road, and Obama has expanded it to a six-lane freeway.
I think that is absolutely true. That's the metaphor I was looking for. And who is at the end of that freeway? That's what worries me.
Yeah. Well, and let me also include my side of this, the so-called Fourth Estate. The media has been very lame. They will report certain aspects of these issues, but we're not seeing the kind of full-throated action that was taken against Nixon that really set the stage for the FISA law that we're talking about. And I'm curious to know, because before we started recording, I mentioned that our local newspaper, the San Francisco Chronicle, which has provided generally excellent coverage and timely coverage of the various steps in this lengthy process, did not report your determination not to pursue an appeal. And I found out about it online from Wired Magazine.
Right. I wrote a piece about it for one of the California legal newspapers called the Daily Journal.
And do I have your permission to post that?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. But
you might need permission from the Daily Journal itself. I have no idea, but that's not my problem.
They can sue me.
They can sue you, but not me.
And you'll represent me, right?
I might.
Yeah.
I published that. I submitted that piece to the Daily Journal because I was writing at that point for lawyers, not for a general audience. And it's a personal piece. It's about how I feel about having lost this case after so many years and how I'm not particularly upset by it because I feel that I remained true to myself. I did what I thought was right. I never thought my chances of winning were good and that I did a good thing even if I lost. But I thought about writing a different sort of piece, an op-ed piece about the end of the Al Haramain case for, say, the New York Times, or the L.A. Times, or the San Francisco Chronicle, and I didn't do it. The reason why I didn't do it, because I do not believe they would have published such a piece,
mm-hmm.
because they're no longer interested. When I won the Al Haramain case before Judge Walker in 2010, it was the lead story in the New York Times the next day. Front page, top, lead story, and that was a Friday, I believe. And then the following Sunday, it was their lead editorial. Mm-hmm. It was big news. My phone was ringing off the hook for a while. When I lost the case 2 years later in the Ninth Circuit, it was in no newspaper whatsoever except the San Francisco Chronicle. It was no longer news. The powers that be the editors of these major daily newspapers, they do not believe warrantless wiretapping is of general interest anymore. It's over. It's yesterday's news. I don't think they care all that much about torture anymore, except a movie comes out about torture, and suddenly that puts it in the news. But I don't know how editors decide what's news, but I do know this. They have decided that warrantless wiretapping has played out its cycle. It's not news anymore. I'm not saying nobody cares. I'm saying the editors have decided it's not news.
Well, what if you co-authored an op-ed with Lady Gaga?
That is something that would probably work, and if I could get her to wear, like, some kind of ammunition brassiere,
uh-huh.
something like that, you know, that's what attracts people these days. When, I'll tell you something, during that period when I won the Al Haramain case, and I did a lot of newspaper interviews, I got one call from TV. It was the Colbert Report. They wanted to fly me out there and do a bit with Stephen Colbert.
Wow.
And then 2 days later, they called me and they said, something else came up. We've scratched your bit.
Oh, wow.
You're not going to come out. And I was teaching at Hastings at the time. And I mentioned that I was going to be on this Colbert show. And the students got so excited. And one of them said, but I said to them, I'm not comfortable with the idea of doing Al Haramain. It's comedy. And she said, but this is where we all get our news.
Right.
I thought, oh, no.
Wow.
So now I got to do a comedy bit to raise consciousness about warrantless wiretapping. It didn't happen.
So television news never covered you at all? 60 Minutes never called and none of the other magazine shows?
I'm trying to think. No, I did a lot of radio,
mm-hmm.
including you. Radio, I did NPR a few times, I think. I did a lot of radio, which tends to be much more in-depth. Yeah, I can get 20 minutes on the radio. I get 3 minutes on 60 minutes, but on the local news or the evening news. I've done a lot of TV over the years in other cases, and it's very, very shallow. It's headlines.
Sure, yeah.
That's just the nature of it, and they're looking for, you know, you give them a half-hour interview, and you get a two-sentence soundbite. And so I don't particularly enjoy doing TV, but I'll do it if I think it's going to achieve anything.
Sure.
But TV was not interested in the Al Haramain case. It was too complicated. Look how long it took you to describe the case at the outset of this broadcast here.
Yeah.
It takes 3 minutes to describe it. And plus, it takes you having done 7 interviews with me to even understand it enough to be able to describe it in 2 minutes.
Well, I have had practice.
Yes, you have. And so have I. It's a weird time we're living through now. People don't seem to care about torture and enhanced interrogation and wiretapping and drones and
cyber warfare without any declaration or any debate.
And most disturbing to me, the the growth of the national security state.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that that everything we do is ending up in a government file somewhere now, and their only challenge is to figure out how to manage it. So that's kind of scary, but you know, we're dinosaurs. Those of us who are frightened by invasions of privacy, by loss of privacy, we're dinosaurs.
Well, you're going to put this up on your Facebook page?
I don't have a Facebook page. I told you I'm a dinosaur.
Well, John, as we wrap up here, in the piece that you wrote, you declare that you're not bitter. You feel that you did what you could, and you're proud of what you achieved. And I don't dispute that in any way. But what is the lesson, if there is one, that this has left with you?
Oh, the lesson that this has left with me. Do what you got to do. Be true to yourself. Do it for years if you have to, as a lawyer at least, is what I'm talking about, whatever kind of work you do. The success is not in whether or not you achieve victory. The success is in whether or not you have done your best and been true to yourself and feel good about what you've done. And that's where I'm at. I feel like I succeeded in this litigation. I raised a lot of awareness. I twisted the tail of the government for 7 years.
You shredded a banana in their shredder?
Yeah, I just watched a banana being shredded. I learned a lot of frightening stuff. I had a lot of fun. It was good. It was a good thing to be doing as a lawyer, and I'm happy that I did it. And maybe someday someone else 10, 20 years from now will be inspired by what I did or what some of my colleagues did or what some other people did in some of these other cases. And, you know, when I'm old and listening to the Rolling Stones in my skilled nursing facility, some younger person will take up where I left off and maybe do a little bit better than I did.
Thank you, John. I really appreciate that you took this on, and I wish you had gotten paid for it, and I wish you had prevailed. But like you, I have no regrets that you know, we've covered this and attempted to give some visibility to the work that you put into it and to the principles that you have stood up for.
Thank you, and I also want to acknowledge it wasn't just me. There was a team of 5 dedicated individuals, Stephen Goldberg and Ashley Albies and Tom Nelson and Lisa Jaskell and me and Zaha Hassan. All 6 of us worked for a long period of time on this case. We worked as a team, and aside from everything else I told you, I made a lot of new friends. That was good.
All right.
Okay.
John Eisenberg, I'll talk to you later when you have another case. Please do stay in touch.
Okay, it's been great.
Happy trails to John Eisenberg, and now we know the Fourth Amendment, well, it's optional in the United States, if the president says so.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.